I want to see science serve a useful purpose to improve the standard of living for all people.
Why is anyone fighting food advance? A very small percentage of the world's population is fortunate enough to have the luxury of turning down food.
We've arranged a society based on science and technology in which nobody understands anything about science and technology.
You can't build a peaceful world on empty stomachs and human misery.
You're listening to Talking Biotech, a weekly podcast illuminating issues in agricultural and medical biotechnology. Your questions and concerns are addressed using a science-based approach with the goal of driving discovery to application with communication. Now here's your host, Dr. Kevin Folta.
Yeah, hi, it's me, Kevin. It's Talking Biotech podcast today, and today's a really interesting one that I really was looking forward to for a long time. Today we're going to talk about bananas. Now, we discussed banana domestication back in episode 8. We talked to Dr. Heslop Harrison about genetic origins, breeding, some other really interesting facts about bananas. But the purpose of today's podcast, I want you to think beyond that yellow thing that we get in the grocery store, or that green thing that turns to yellow and then turns brown. If you're like me, I really like bananas. And the problem with bananas is you buy, you know, a hand of bananas, as they call them, of that. You get that set of green bananas, and they're in the zone for like one day, you know, in the perfect banana zone. And so I'm really off topic. I had like a whole plan here as to what I was going to discuss, and I wandered into one of my things that I just can't stand. They all ripen at the same time. And I started to take the ones, like the single ones that would get put down at the bottom, and kind of create a little banana rainbow so that every day I had one banana in the banana zone. One thing that I've learned from Valerie Bertinelli, and I don't know why this was on TV or where I was or what the circumstances were, but she was talking about how, you know, people waste so many bananas. You can cut up the banana flesh, get rid of the peel, cut up the banana flesh, put it in freezer bags and keep them that way. And it works. So then you can have frozen bananas for things. Anyway, back to the podcast. I want you to think about bananas in their context as a world staple crop and a really important export for a lot of countries in the developing world. Bananas are the eighth most important food crop in the world. And in the developing world, in terms of food security, they're the fourth most important. So if you think about bananas out of the context of the industrialized world grocery store and that, you know, yellow, green, brown thing, bananas are really, really critical to world food security. 90% of bananas, or about 90%, are eaten locally. So you see these tremendous plantations and the export that goes on to bring bananas to the industrialized world. We know we get a lot of bananas here. That's 10% of how much is eaten. And everything else is a daily food staple. Now, when we talk about bananas, we're thinking about this thing we get in the grocery store in North America, this Cavendish dessert banana. And that's the way we need to think about that. That's a dessert banana. And that's grown on these extensive plantations in Costa Rica, Belize, Ecuador, Panama, Honduras, down in that area. It also is the same family as things like plantains. So we can think about plantains as a slightly more starchy banana that we can use for cooking. And it's delicious. There are other types of bananas also that we think of more broadly as cooking bananas. That's about 25% of what's grown on the planet. That's a majority of what's consumed in the developing world. And lesser known dessert types. So you have these other kinds of small bananas that people also consume as a fruit. The problem is that there are tremendous threats to banana production. One of the big issues about bananas is that they are truly monocultures. And we talk about people, oh, monocultures in corn, monocultures in soy, oh, but that's nothing compared to what we have in terms of banana. You see, bananas are all clonally propagated. They're actually an herb. And they're clonally propagated from a foundational plant that has a number of qualities, including resistance to disease and superior fruit quality and yields. So once you find that, it's very difficult to breed bananas. So when you get that one good clone, now you propagate lots of it. And you don't propagate them by seeds because they're triploid. They have an extra set of chromosomes. So they're sterile. But that's what makes them seedless. So you see the problem. In order to have a seedless banana that you can't propagate by seeds, you now have to propagate by vegetative cuttings, which opens the door to a whole plethora of different diseases to work their way around the genetic mechanisms that make them immune. And today there's a whole suite of different banana diseases that we can think about. Things like black Sigatoka, fusarium wilt is a major issue, banana xanthomonas wilt, banana bungee top virus, which is a virus, viral disease, banana streak virus is another one, and lots of pests like weevils, nematodes, all that kind of good stuff. The fusarium wilt is really a major issue. And today we'll talk to Dr. Lena Tripathi. She will tell us mostly about xanthomonas wilt and ways to combat that on the African continent. But just to give you some more background on fusarium, fusarium is the pathogen, Fusarium oxysporum, that killed the favorite banana called Gros Michel, or Big Mike. That banana was destroyed. It's the one that maybe your grandparents will talk about as a very fruity, sweet banana. That one was destroyed by the pathogen, and it was replaced by Cavendish. And currently, there's something called Tropical Race 4, which is a type of Fusarium oxysporum that is threatening Cavendish. And it's very hard to control. It lives in the soil. It's easily spread by even a pair of boots. If you don't have impeccable hygiene on a banana plantation, you can spread these diseases. One of the most interesting things that is happening is that Tropical Race 4 Fusarium oxysporum is a clone. A clone that's killing a clone. So the clone of the pathogen, all genetically identical, a monoculture of a pathogen, right? Is now killing a very monolithic crop. A little touche. So the question is, why would we use genetic engineering to solve problems in banana? And traditional breeding is inherently difficult. Bananas have low fertility. It's difficult to make crosses work. It's really a tricky business. So scientists have been taking the elite bananas that have already been bred and are simply adding a gene or two. And that's been happening since the 1990s. They've installed nematode resistance, the vitamin A synthesis that we talked about back in episode 3, I think. But most of them have to do with disease. They've installed everything from lysozyme, which is an enzyme found in tears that has antibacterial properties, to plant defense genes called defensins. And maybe the most famous is XA21, which is a disease resistance gene from rice, which was identified from a wild species of rice back in the 90s. And that seems to have some good effects in bananas as well. Perhaps the biggest threat is this banana xanthomonas wilt, at least in the lakes region of Africa, which is like Burundi, Rwanda, Uganda, Kenya area. The big issue is that there's no commercial chemical control. You also don't have resistant cultivars. So in order to grow bananas, you're really dependent upon horticulture and good practices on the farm. And it's also extremely labor intensive. So this is why banana disease is so important and why genetic engineering has a unique opportunity to maybe be a very strong game changer in that particular area. So just to remember then, bananas are a really important world food crop, number of pathogens that affect it, and very limited natural sources of resistance. And you can't use chemical controls in most cases. The big deal is that for every single banana disease that's been initiated or that's been identified, there has been research into and solutions found in genetic engineering. So all of these crops, there's quite a few of them that are being grown in research tracks all over Africa. The governments are participating in their trials as well as their development. So it's an exciting time to think about bananas, and it's an exciting time for bananas to become an important first step in the wider spread adoption of good genetic engineering technologies to solve problems for people. So off today, in today's interview. Today on the Talking Biotech podcast, I'm very pleased to be able to spend time with Dr. Lena Tripathi. Lena is the Deputy Director of East African Hub of IITA, which is the International Institute for Tropical Agriculture. It's one of the 15 CGIR centers. She's leading the transgenic research program there, and that comes out of Nairobi, Kenya. So welcome to Talking Biotech Podcast, Dr. Tripathi.
Yeah, thanks, Kevin.
So why is IITA interested in bananas? Why is it important to the region?
As you mentioned, you know, IITA is one of the CG centers based in Africa. And then we work on four thematic areas, the biotechnology and genetic improvement, natural resource management, social science, and plant health. And actually, the IITA's main focus is to develop solutions to reduce poverty, increase food security, improve health and nutrition. And we focus on crops, and that includes banana and plantain, cassava, cowpea, soybean, maize, yam, and cocoa. And that's why I'm working on bananas, because that's IITA's mandate crop. But also, banana is very important staple food crop for Africa, particularly for the East Africa. So East Africa actually produce almost like one third of the world production of banana. When I said it's a staple food, is more like, you know, rice in the other countries. So, for example, in Uganda, you know, one person can consume up to like 1.6 kilos of bananas per day. So it's not like a fruit crop, it's a really food for them.
And are you talking about the kind of the, just to clarify, what we think of in the West is like the dessert banana, or are you talking more like the starchy plantains?
So I'm talking about both. When I said banana, it includes plantain as well. But in Uganda, there is a special type of bananas called matoke. So those are cooking bananas. So we are talking, so now when we talk about bananas, that includes desert bananas, cooking bananas, and as well as plantains.
And can you tell me a little bit about what the average farmer in this region, what is a plantation like? Is it a really smallholder operation with maybe just a few acres, or are these really tremendous acreage like we see in South or Central America?
Actually, in Africa, the banana plantations are mainly the smallholder. So it's run by the smallholder farmers. It's not like a big commercial farm.
And what are the major limitations that those farmers face?
So, you know, the diseases and pest is definitely the major limitation. But on top of that, you know, the decreasing fertility of soil, and then the other inputs like, you know, the fertilizer, the irrigation, those are also the components. But the major limitation is actually the diseases and pest.
And so do farmers in those areas have access to chemical pesticides and other types of controls?
No, the farmers, as I said, you know, the banana is normally grown by smallholder farmers. So it's very difficult for them to afford the chemicals. So they don't have access to chemicals.
So I guess maybe one approach to solve these problems for these farmers would have plants that would protect themselves. And what are some of the major diseases that these farmers are facing?
So the farmers, if you talk about Africa, so like I think I'm like focusing more on Africa. So we have fungal diseases like Fusarium oxysporum. So that's Fusarium wilt. Also black sigatoka. And then there is a relatively newer bacterial disease threat. That's Xanthomonas wilt, caused by Xanthomonas campestris pathovermiceserum. There are also viral diseases like banana bunchy top virus and also banana streak viruses. Then there are pests like nematodes and as well as weevils. So these are some of the major diseases and pests.
And it's really amazing the spectrum of different diseases that you see that threaten banana. How much of that is due to a lack of varieties, that these are really more than most crops? Certainly monocultures are coming as clones in these plantations.
I will not agree to your point, because I think when you talk about Africa, it's not really monoculture, because, you know, it's not grown by commercial big farmers, you know. So you will find a lot of diversity, a lot of varieties of banana and plantains there, you know. So these are some of the pathogens are like, it's like from ages, some are the new pathogens, and then because of the climate change and all, you know, so the pathogen is like spreading fast. Like, for example, Xanthomonas wilt was not there long ago, you know. It was, okay, it was there in Ethiopia, but it was quite confined. But once it's jumped to Uganda, it was reported in 2001. Since then, it's spreading quite fast in East Africa. And it doesn't affect only one or two varieties. It affects all the varieties grown in East Africa. So I think that's the one example I gave you, you know.
It's really good to know that there's more genetic diversity than previously thought. And how many different varieties are grown? And are these clonal varieties, or is this a heterogeneous population?
So there are a lot of varieties, you know. I cannot give you exact number, but then, you know, if you talk about the desert bananas, then yes, it's like quite dominated by Cavendish. And also there is another apple bananas called Sukalendize. But in terms of the cooking bananas as well as plantain, there are a lot of varieties. And then the varieties are actually depending upon what farmers prefer in their own farm. So it's quite diverse, and not all of them are the clonal ones.
Okay. I guess the other interesting part, so let's go to, we'll weave this back in a minute. When you talk about Xanthomonas wilt, what are some of the current solutions from a genetic engineering standpoint?
So for the genetic, the short-term solution is actually to apply the cultural practices. You know, so that means following the phytosanitary practices. But those are not very stable solution, because not all farmers can afford doing that. But in terms of the genetic engineering, so we were trying to find the solution. Actually, my lab has been involved for several years developing these solutions, and we tried several different genes. So we tested two different genes from sweet pepper. They're called plant ferredoxin-like protein, PFLP, and another one is hypersensitive response assisting protein, HRAP. So those two genes we have tested. So we developed the transgenic bananas using those two genes independently, and we have tested the plants initially in the laboratory conditions and in the glasshouse condition. And then after that, the promising lines were tested also in the confined field trials in Uganda. The another genes we tested also is XA21 from rice, and as well as the NH1. So far, actually, I will say there are four different genes which has been tested for providing resistance to Xanthomonas wilt.
And I've read a lot of those papers, and it's really exciting to see that there are a number of solutions that can target the same pathogen. And the picture is online, and I maybe I'll make the references available to the listener. But if you look at the pictures, like in the rice XA21 paper, you can really see the difference between the transgenic and control plants, along with like the stem cross sections where you look at the bacterial ooze that comes out of them. It's really dramatic. And I didn't know if what are you looking at opportunities to stack these traits into one genetic background? Is that currently the thinking?
Yes. So we are much more advanced actually using this PFLP and HRAP gene. So we have proof of concept at the field level. So we have tested transgenic bananas expressing PFLP gene as well as the HRAP gene independently. And then these field trials has been conducted in Uganda. We have tested for like five generation these plants in Uganda under field condition, and then they are holding the resistance very well. But as you know, bacteria evolve very fast. So there is always a risk while using single gene resistance. So that's why we are stacking PFLP and HRAP gene together. We have already developed plants by stacking these two genes together. We have recently published that paper as well. So what we see is we don't see any synergistic effect by combining these two genes. But what we want to test in the field is whether that can provide the durable resistance.
And that's good news, because I know many cases with especially Xanthomonas where you look like you have very good chemical control, but because just of the numbers of bacteria, that it does work around the transgenic controls very quickly. And do you find that, so do farmers who are, well, let me go back and say this again, but during the trials, are you seeing examples where you're seeing resistance around your transgenic solution?
So actually, so far in our five generation trial, so we did actually two confined field trials. And in none of the trial, we actually saw any single plant breaking resistance.
Oh, that's good news.
But then I think I will say that's still too early to say anything, you know, means like, and then we have also tested those ones at one location. So now what we are doing is we are also planning to test in Kenya. We are starting a trial pretty soon, maybe in by mid this year. And we are also going multi-location in Uganda. So I think that will give us more clear answer about, you know, about the durable resistance as well. And I think if you are interested to learn more about the PFLP and HRAP, we have several publication. Actually, our field trial results are published in Nature Biotech in 2014.
And I guess the question I should have asked you up front is, what does Xanthomonas wilt look like on the banana plantation, and how bad is it as a problem in your region?
I think when the plants get infected, the early symptoms are actually wilting of leaves. That's how you will see. But then after that, you know, if this is like an insect-borne disease, so it spreads through insect, and the insect normally infect the plants through the flowers. So if the insect has gone through the flower, you will also see the shriveling of the flower. And if the plant is mature enough, then you'll see the immature ripening of bananas, the fruit. And then if you cut the fruit, you will see the fruits has this black scar inside. So it doesn't have any edible quality. The disease is spread very fast. So once the disease is in the field, it will take only a few months to wipe off the field. And then there is absolute yield loss. So it can take like a few months to get, farmers will not get any output of that field. I'm not saying the whole country has that, but what I'm saying is like if that same field, once the disease goes in, so the disease was initially in Ethiopia, but then after it has come to Uganda, now it has spread to different countries. So now it's there in DR Congo, in Kenya, Burundi, Rwanda, and Tanzania. And it affects all different cultivars. So that's why it's like considered as the most serious threat to the banana plantation in East Africa.
And what about fungal diseases? I know you mentioned Fusarium, which is causing problems worldwide in different forms. But what is Fusarium like in Africa? And what are some of the major symptoms, and how bad is that spreading regionally?
So at moment, you know, we have like a Fusarium wilt. You know that one is everywhere, the Fusarium wilt, which affects gross Michel variety and also the Sicalindese. Both the cultivars are very, very susceptible. But then the tropical race 4 is at moment is only in one country, in Mozambique. is not in other countries in Africa. And there are a lot of varieties which are actually resistant to fusarium, means folk race 1 and race 2, and that's what is in mainly in the countries. So, like, for example, the Matoke varieties are quite resistant. The plantains are also quite resistant to fusarium wilt. But we don't know what will happen if the tropical race 4 spreads from Mozambique to the other countries. So it's becoming actually a quite sensitive issue, you know, to find out the solution for the tropical race 4.
And how is tropical race 4 spread?
I think that the disease, so fusarium is a soil borne. So it can, you know, it spreads through the soil, it spreads through the planting material. Means all the disease, even the bacterial disease also spread through the planting material. But bacterial disease is not a soil borne, but fusarium is a soil borne disease. So, you know, it can, you know, even from the shoes, you know, you can spread the pathogen. And the another thing for fusarium is the pathogen can survive in the soil for a long time in comparison to the bacterial pathogen, because the bacterial pathogen can only survive up to maximum of up to 6 months if the banana debris is not there.
I've heard a lot about the extreme levels of horticultural hygiene that need to be practiced on certain plantations because of issues like fusarium. And it seems really extreme that, you know, constantly maintaining plant material, keeping the dead material off the ground, constantly cleaning your tools. How extreme is it? Like, what are some of the more extreme cases?
So I think if I give you the example of the bacterial wilt, you know, the management using these horticultural practices is quite laborious, because, you know, as soon as the farmer sees the symptom, you know, they need to uproot the plant. You know, banana plant is quite huge, you know, so removing that and then every time, you know, cleaning the tools. So all these practices are quite labor intensive. And all 100% farmers needs to follow that, because if like one farmer is following and the neighboring farmer is not following, so then diseases like bacterial wilt, which is spreads through as well as through insects, the disease still goes to the farmer who is even practicing that. So I think that's the challenge. Because of the labor intensiveness, not all the farmers follow the cultural practices.
And what is black sigatoka? It sounds like another really nasty disease over there.
Yeah, is a fungal disease caused by Microsphaerella. So you see like a black spots on the leaves, and it's, so that means this the leaf area for the photosynthesis gets reduced, so the plant has the lower yields.
And the other one that I see commonly in the literature is banana bunchy top virus. Is there a good control for the virus?
So banana bunchy top virus is also, yes, you are right. The banana bunchy top virus is also a big problem, not only in Africa, worldwide. So wherever there is banana, particularly the Cavendish, but also the plantains. There is also no resistant varieties for banana bunchy top virus. So you means I think right now, we have a project actually in collaboration with Queensland University of Technology in Australia, where we are developing the solution to banana bunchy top virus using the transgenic approach.
And I guess that leads me to the next logical question. So you've talked about really four diseases that are strongly impacting bananas or have the potential to have very strong impacts on a food staple in Africa. And how accepting are, so I know that your work has accelerated very well in demonstrating the efficacy of transgenic approaches, but how excited are the governments to implement these technologies?
So I think what I'll say is, like, you know, a team of socioeconomists has done some ex ante impact analysis, which also has the component on adoption. And that study clearly says that the rate of adoption is quite high. So once these varieties, but I'm focusing more on the Xanthomonas wilt. That's what the study was about. GM bananas resistant to Xanthomonas wilt. And then the adoption will be somewhere like between 20 to 70% after the release of the variety and reaching up to 100% in few years' time, depending upon the country. So the country which is hit most with the disease will have the higher adoption rate. But then you know that, you know, not all countries has the biosafety law in place. So that's the big challenge.
Well, what is the biosafety law?
Which allows you to commercialize the GM crop.
So
you have to have biosafety law in the country in order to commercialize the GM crop.
And which are the countries that currently have that law in place?
So Kenya has that law in place. And then Kenya is affected with this disease as well. Means there are several countries where this law is in place.
I guess occasionally we hear about pushback against the deployment of these technologies in Africa. And are there is there really opposition, like active opposition, especially from Western individuals or Western organizations, that's happening on the ground in places like Kenya?
Definitely, you know, there are some effect with the from the Western world, but I will not say that's like a critical factor here.
Well, that's good news. So it seems like do you think it's because these are technologies that are coming from organizations like IITA and you know your laboratory and aren't being commercialized from major corporations, or are they being commercialized by major corporations?
So IITA is not working alone on these projects. You know, we are working with national partners. So on all our projects, we have national partners. And then this technology is like when developed in-house, I will say. For example, developed by Ugandans for Uganda. So I think that has much more support from the government in comparison to when you're bringing the technology from outside of Africa.
Yeah, I agree. And I think this is really exciting. And you read a lot more lately, especially from African authors, about, you know, letting Africa solve Africa's problems and not rely on outsiders to come in and do things that it can do itself. And it's been really exciting to hear about the technology explosion that's been happening in places like Kenya to address the problems of food security on the continent. So that's something that I see growing from my perspective. Can you give us an idea about how that infrastructure is growing in places like Kenya?
So I'm based at Becca Hub. So this is a facility which is like a center of excellence. It's hosted by one of the CG center called International Livestock Research Institute. And that's really a very, very nice facility. It's actually equivalent to the lab in anywhere in the developed countries. So we also build a lot of capacity. Means that's like one of the, I will say, mandate for CG centers, CGIR institutes, that we build local capacity. So on our projects, we do the human capacity. We train a lot of students and the scientific staff. So I will say that even the infrastructure is coming up very strongly, not only in Kenya, but in Uganda as well. So in Uganda, actually, NARO, which is the National Agriculture Research Organization, has in their two different centers, they have very nice biotech facility to conduct transgenic research. And I think Ethiopia is also coming up in that line, you know, like on one of our project actually at EIR, Ethiopian Agriculture Research Institute also is building the capacity for transgenic research.
So if all goes really well, when is the soonest that these products could be available for commercialization?
So the GM banana for Xanthomonas wilt, our plan is that the first product will be released by 2020 in either in Kenya or Uganda or in both countries.
That's pretty exciting. Is there a pipeline that follows with the other solutions shortly after?
Yes, actually, the project which we are not developing, I'm not involved in that project. I think the project led by James Dale from Queensland University of Technology in Australia, I think they are developing this biofortified bananas in collaboration with national program in Uganda called NARO. And that product actually should be, has the same timeline.
And are you thinking about doing any co-transformations with a biofortification and disease fortification into the same background?
Yeah, that's all in plan, but we haven't started that yet.
Yeah, it's easy to come up with ideas when you don't have to do them. So
we need to look for the funding before we start that approach, because both projects has proof of concept. So like we have proof of concept for Xanthomonas wilt resistance, and they have proof of concept for high provitamin A. And so I think both the technologies are proven, and then it should be, means ideally it should be stacked.
So Dr. Tripathi, if people wanted to learn more about the projects going on in your laboratory or any social media face for IATA, where would they look?
So I think you can get more information on the IATA website, that is www.iata.org, and IATA is on Twitter as well. And then I think, yes, I'm on ResearchGate and I'm also on LinkedIn. So those are some social media we can get more information about my publication and about the projects.
About your many publications. I learned about you, I've known about your work for a long time, but I've never really dug in until I had to do a presentation for a plant pathology class or a plant pathology club. And I chose banana diseases because of all of the really innovative transgenic approaches that have happened for so many different diseases. And it was exciting because it's kind of an unusual situation where you have a world food staple, many different diseases, and many different solutions. And for this reason, I really wanted to present that. And you are the star of the show.
Thank you very much.
So thank you very much for taking the time to spend with me today. That's Dr. Lena Tripathi coming to us all the way from IITA in Nairobi, Kenya. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks, Kevin.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech podcast. Now, since the reboot only a few weeks ago, we've seen tremendous increases in the number of listeners, and we thank you for that. You're obviously telling friends and family, retweeting episodes, and sharing them in social media space. That's great, because you are the amplifier to our little microphone. Now, if you have questions you would like to hear answered here, send a tweet to @TalkingBiotech or send an email to TalkingBiotech@gmail.com. And remember, this pirate ship is 100% supported personally by Kevin Folda, and no outside contributions are ever accepted. I always tell him it's a bonehead move, because if everybody sent him a penny, he could cover his annual costs in a week or two. That means lots of folks are downloading the production and enjoying the content. The amazing stories of plant biology and new technology open our eyes to where our food comes from, as well as where it can go, as moving innovation to application requires communication. We now return to Talking Biotech, already in progress.
Yeah, thanks, Vern. So because of the long introduction today, before I spoke with Dr. Tripathi, I'm going to delay doing more questions for until next week. One important point about Dr. Tripathi's discussion is that the African continent does have a large number of different varieties that are available. She corrected me when I said that these were large monocultures, as I said in the introduction. What she reminds us is that many of these areas don't have the necessary propagation ability to be able to make monocultures. You're dealing with what's there. You're playing with the cards that are dealt, and there's many different varieties that are there. It probably has a lot to do with also separating the timing of fruit set and spreading out, you know, what a farmer would have in terms of immediate access to a crop. So it's important for us to think about bananas, because I do think bananas may be that gateway crop to larger acceptance. We're looking at maybe 2 or 3, maybe 4 years out before the Xanthomonas wilt bananas are widely deployed, and also beta carotene enriched bananas. So these are pretty close. These are coming along. And they don't have much to do, which was refreshing to hear her say, with Western activism, that it seems like, at least in Kenya, things are pretty good, and that the technologies stand a good chance at being widely accepted and help the people they were designed to serve. So knowing about bananas, why they are so important, again, the fourth most important crop in the developing world, knowing why they're important, understanding the tremendous number of threats that may limit production, and then understanding how genetic engineering solutions are really the best tool to solve those problems. It makes an excellent point for anybody communicating the science. It allows for us to have an example that when someone talks about, you know, corn and Roundup Ready and BT, say, hold on a second. Let's go back and talk about how this technology can help people. And Dr. Tripathi's example is an excellent example of that. Send your questions to talkingbiotech@gmail.com or send them via Twitter to @talkingbiotech. I'm Kevin Folta. I thank you so much for listening. It's wonderful to share science with you every week, and look forward to talking to you again next time on Talking Biotech Podcast.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech Podcast. Please send your suggestions for guests, comments, or questions to talkingbiotech@gmail.com. Please write a review on iTunes and recommend this podcast to a friend. More downloads and reviews raise the visibility of this podcast and help us reach a wider audience with science.